Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here. It's great to see you. I was working my butt off quite a bit, and been trying to find that work-life balance that everybody's on about. And it can be hard to even define what balance is when we don't have a lot of time. You know, so I'm working 6 days a week right now, and this is my only day off. And I've been holding a lot of animosity the day before my day off, or before my last day that I got to work. I've been habituated to the old system of, you know, I worked 5 days a week for a long time, which arguably some people would say that's too much. You know, like, I know there's other countries that have 4 day work weeks and like shorter days, and it just sounds nice. You know, I know even tribal cultures seem to, at least in one of the reports that I read, which just might be invalidated, and please argue with me. If you want to find me on the email address and give me the opposite, I'm fine with that too. But I read somewhere that tribal cultures spend on average about 4 to 6 hours a day looking for food. And you know, that might be hard work, it might be manual labor, and it might not be sitting in an office chair, but still, I work almost 9 hours a day, 6 days a week. So like, what the fuck? I would much rather go do all that manual fucking farming or foraging or whatever in lieu of making a consumer product for a person, for a business that does not respect the actual person itself. You know, like, as a cog in the machine nowadays, we're all just like, we're not physically making our own tools and our own, you know, objects that we need to survive, or even the things that we're bartering for the things that we survive. We just fucking make things for money, for this abstract dollar that supposedly has backed up by gold or silver or something. You know, I know I'm not being very articulate here about the matter, but it's just, I'm so sick of the business-minded aspect of Western society. Like, I've been shticked a lot by businesses and by people who are in this business-sided mind where they're not thinking humanely about people anymore. At this position, all they have is the bottom line and this, you know, profit-oriented idea of success, you know, like here's an example. I work in a restaurant, which restaurants prolifically don't tend to make enough money to support themselves, just how they're set up, you know? So like, if you have like a $10 like item of food, roughly 5% of that should be going to your labor. Like, so if you sell $100 worth of food, $5 is for the employees, supposedly. And this is out of a long-term looking at it. It's not just one item, you know? So in a day, you might sell $3,000 worth of shit. And that would be a cumulative of being able to spend about $250 for labor staff at that point, if you're trying to hit those metrics. But to me, that's stupid. And I know you have to do something to succeed as a business, but the fact that the only way things can survive and operate is as these businesses, it's just, to me, it seems a cosmic giggle when it comes to a shortfall in capitalism. And I'm not going to talk about this much longer because I'm already boring myself, but like, I've just been dealing with frustrations in myself, and I'm working so much to be able to keep a head over, a roof over our shoulders. And I know so many of you are doing the exact same thing, devoting your time and effort and energy into trying to support you and your family. And with inflation on the rise and with how everything just seems to be getting more and more expensive, it just seems like we're working harder for less. And now I'm just working more and more, and I'm trying not to be pessimistic and forecasting a future or a scenario where I no longer have any free time. But to me, my time is important. My free time, my ability to rest and to be isolated, to have privacy. And I know that's a novel idea because at most points in human history, I don't think privacy was even something that was accessible. You know, the tribal cultures that I referenced earlier, even though I was portraying them in a shiny manner, it's very unlikely that my ego, my sense of self would be very happy in that sort of culture because I have developed an intense need for privacy. And it's got me thinking a lot about where that comes from and if it's unnatural, but I really enjoy being able to take time to myself. And I find myself very introspective and introverted when it comes to charging my batteries in my alone time and in my readings and in my wanderings. And a lot of the times my alone time includes my son because he's unitized as part of my process, the way that I see it. You know, but as I see my time, quote unquote, this thing that I'm nervous about its functionality and usefulness, but as I see this my time, I see it shrinking. And that's led me to have frustrations and have angers. And I've been battling not fucking up the time that I do have by feeling frustrated and angry. And I find it just really counterproductive in the whole grand scheme of the thing. Like, one of the little moments that I've been focusing on is the fact that I have every evening, no matter when I work, I always get to come home and there's still a couple hours in my house. And if I spend that whole time just being pissed off because I got to go work tomorrow, that I can't enjoy the present moment here and now. Like, I can't even be, and I can't even rest, and I can't even breathe because I'm so pissed off about tomorrow and all the people that I've allocated as having responsibility in the matter, as that gets even more tedious. Like, I guess I'm just sharing all these ideas and feelings about how I've been going through my week. And I'm wondering if you can relate to that, because I'm not sure exactly what the solutions are, other than, you know, doubling down on some of these principles that I've been in practice, like these ideas of attention and involvement. Like, my day yesterday at work was fine. I had a good time, if that makes any sense. Even though I was ambivalent about it, even though I was angry that I had to go do it, once I got there and I was working, I was great. And I was vibing, and I was listening to my shows, and I was enjoying the weather of the day. And I found a sense of that solitude even though I was working, and I was lucky to have a job where I don't have to be around people too much. But it makes sense to me that we have these like equilibrium meters, these sensors, is like a level. Like, do you know a level when you put it on the wood and then you can see the bubble? It tells you how centered and wood is with the idea of gravity, I guess, where we are. I guess the level would be different everywhere on the planet, right? It's relative, but like, how do we level out being able to sense when we're in a mode of change? Does that make sense? I think so. But like, sometimes it's hard to even notice when there is a mode of change. Like, here's an example and a counter direction to what I was just discussing. I was given a tremendous gift by my parents for my birthday, because my birthday was on Wednesday. And now I'm 29 years old and I still feel young like a baby because there's still a 2 in front of the number. But I also feel old because the 3 is almost about to take the 2's place. And I know 30-year-olds aren't that old, but I remember being a teenager just like it was yesterday. And I guess in a lot of places I need to grow up a tad bit, you know. But birthdays are always so strange for me because I don't know how to take gifts right. And when I noticed how I was responding to material things, which happened when I was very young, because I would ask for things and then get them. And then selfishly as a child, that can be just amazing because you feel like you're in deserving mint of it. But the older I got, the bigger the gift got, the more I was worried over whether it should be mine in the first place. And what my parents did for me for my birthday this year to help lighten the load, because I've been so stressed financially and struggling to meet that finishing line, being able to meet that specification for where I could be worth of that idea of security, they gave me the gift of paying off my car, which is almost $3,000 that was left on it. I still had about 2 years of car payments left with the interest. But they just paid it off. And so now that's $250 a month. It's not a bill anymore. And I paid off all the mechanics work from last year. And so that's another $150 a month that was on credit. And my responsibilities have shrunk a considerable a bit. And I feel wonderful. I feel guilty because somebody did it for me, and maybe that shouldn't be faulted. Maybe we need to be able to have the ability to take grace like that and go back to childhood and feel like maybe we deserve that grace sometimes. But it's hard for me to give that allowance. But I have a little bit more room, and I don't need to worry as much about working as much as I was doing. You know, and practically overnight. And that's a change. And I've noticed I've been spending money a little bit more haphazardly. And I think I need to retain my carefulness and my thriftiness. But when we encounter a space of change, it's novel and it's compelling when we make decisions on how we're wanting to continue forward into the change. And I'm getting to that hippy dippy woohoo part of the episode where I start to confuse myself, but I find it valuable to mark these moments. And it makes me think back to concepts from Tibetan Buddhism, of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where they had the bardos, and a bardo is an in-between moment. And in between two things, and something else. And that could be potentially in the existential theories, maybe in between a being and a nothing and a being. You know, some of the bardos that were mentioned in this book were like in between consciousness and unconsciousness, like when you're passed out. And then there's in between unconsciousness and dreaming, and back from dreaming into unconsciousness, dreaming into consciousness. There's in between life and in between death, and then the in between that's in between death and in between life. Like, there's so many transferences from ideas in that realm of existence once we're in concepts and when we're thinking about who we are. The Sartorian for itself, when we've distinguished ourselves from the environment, we've named it. We've called ourselves a me. And in that function, we've taken a piece that doesn't exist off of the whole and essentially made a reality, which the Buddha said was temporal and fleeting and therefore non-existent. And in the ideas of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, you have these ideas of probability, where things can be in multiple places at the same time or exist in two different formats, such as a particle and a wave, purely because this idea of existence apart from totality is an act of perception and man-made. So I think part of that man-made functionability of personality, of manipulability that we need to use to interact with the social systems that we are born into. I think that thing responds either holistically, and it responds with an ability to adapt and, you know, picture the metaphysical ball in a river or a fishing bobber that floats on the surface and goes with the current. Without rudder, without steering, without distinguishment. I think it's possible to be able to be aware of some of these necessary facts of life, because there's something right around the corner right now that you do not expect, that I do not expect, that I couldn't even figure what the best response is going to be, and I'm going to adapt to it, and that's going to build who I am in that instant, which to me proves that who I am in this instant is temporal, is fleeting, is existent, but partially from the whole. And it's for certainly man-made by me, this man right here. And like, I was having a really good conversation with a friend last night about a lot of these things. And spontaneously yesterday, even though I'd worked all day, when I got home, I decided to start a big project. And so now I'm busy. And, you know, I'm killing time right now, which this is a helpful way to stay busy while killing time. So I'm just going to be busy all day, you know. I'm riding myself thin. But we were having a discussion last night about philosophy and religion and these ideas of oneness. And here, I'm going to read you a verse real quick, and then I'll talk more about it. And this is from the Tao Te Ching, one of my favorite books ever, obviously. And I'm going to read this, and I'm going to tell you a paraphrased version of some of the other versions that I've read and why I find them, the differences, interesting. So this is from chapter 42 by Brooke Zipporin's translation, Amalgamation. And here goes. The course generates continuities. Continuities generate polarities. Polarities generate triplicities. Triplicities generate the 10,000 things. All the 10,000 things bear the darkness of shadow on their backs, and as they hug the brightness of sunlight to their breasts. And in the intermingling of these two energies, all their harmonies are formed. Being orphaned, widowed, destitute is what everyone most detests. But kings and princes describe themselves using just these words. And so are things sometimes increased by diminishment, and sometimes diminished by increase. What others teach, we also teach. The violent never die a natural death, and the strong bridging must never be destroyed. We have made this the father of all of our teachings. So the way I always traditionally, or not traditionally, but the way I've seen this rewritten in other translations, because of course in a translation, when you have something that is fundamentally not in English, it's in another language and they have different ways of describing reality, a lot of these pieces of that description, because it's just a language, do not translate from one to the other. And that's one of the faults when it comes to the use of language. But I've also seen this one written as the one becomes two, or no, the Tao becomes the one. So, and then the Tao or the course is potentially void or nothing in certain interpretations. So the Tao becomes one, the one becomes two, the two becomes three, and the three becomes the 10,000 things. And this one, he called one the continuity, and he called two the polarity, and he called three the triplicity. So the continuity is how interconnection works in reality, and how everything is fundamentally you know, interdispersed in itself. There are no pieces in one. And from one comes duality. But duality isn't the pieces either, because duality is this concept, or polarity, is this concept of is or is not, black or white, up or down, hot or cold. But in reality, things aren't truly dual, because everything is constantly in flux and in change. So things are fluctuating from hot to cold and from cold to hot. And things are intermixed. So you never get just hot. You never get just cold. You never see just up. You don't see pure triangles. You have this mixture of concepts. Formal ideas of Plato, these forms, this essential idea of what is that exists, that is more real than what's perceived. You know, that's the land of dualities and polarities. But the mixture generates three. It generates a mixture of the two, a mixture of the yin and the yang, and then you have triplicity. And the triplicities generate the 10,000 things. And in Chinese, this symbol for 10,000 things was like a denominator of a set, like a very, very big set. And the metaphor I used with my buddy last night was that, you know, the biggest denomination of money that you have is $100. So 10,000 things is like a $100 denomination. So you would have multiple denominations of this 10,000 things. And that's how you would talk about really big things. And so here they're discussing all of the things, all the shit that's around us, all the mixtures of atoms. You know, and I was reading this scientific book this morning by this dude named Frank Casper, I think. It's called The Tao of Physics. And it's trying to validate Western and Eastern thought by allowing both to be, if that makes sense. And if you consider how atoms break during nuclear processes, we break the atoms and then they get dispersed into their little particles that are also exist as waves and emit photons that, depending on how you observe them, they fluctuate immensely, because just the immense amount of speed and pressure at these quantum fucking, it blows my goddamn mind. It's so hard for me to even think about. But you have a collider, and then you break atoms on each other, and they break into neutrons and protons, and then that energy makes an immense amount of energy in the breakage, but it's not like they just disappear, all those neutrons and protons and electrons. Fundamentally, they break down into other smaller components, and it's like everything is infinitely destructible and infinitely indestructible, because no matter how you break it, you just make new things. Heraclitus's flux, the idea that you can't step into the same river twice, because it's always flowing and moving, and it's always going to be new water that you're in contact with. Essentially, that's bound with how time is, I believe. Well, that's kind of my little shtick. I know I've been kind of passionate. I've been trying to work through some emotional shit, man, and why I don't want to do things, because that's one of the most frustrating things in my life, is dealing with this notion of not wanting to do things. It's so much easier when I just do things and not have to think about it. So I think you are all lovely people. I hope you know that. I find this opportunity to sit here and do this, even when I'm busy, one of the most cathartic and rewarding experiences in my life. And I'm doing this, I'm trying to express myself, and I'm trying to relate things together and talk about books and dead people to be helpful. I want to be a source of value to the world. And I want to make something that helps other people feel more connected to their world and to themselves, and curious to want to make their meaning systems inherently their own, because that's the only way we can experience reality. We can't read about it. We can't read about how to do it. It's Fight Club. You got to figure out your way of being. And I want people to think about love. And how they can unconditionally love others around them because we're so interconnected, because we're so intimately bound to them. And we can only do that by loving ourselves and having compassion and acceptance for how we respond to change and how sometimes we get ambivalent because we don't want to do things, but we have to be compassionate and soft to that piece because we have to love ourselves first in order to have the foundation to go out and love other people. I believe that wholeheartedly. And I think it's viral. It's like, it's a pandemic if we can make it one. All right, I'm going to go find a book. And then I'll go get Odin and we'll sign you off. And I hope you have just a wonderful day. All right. So I'm reading from Aldous Huxley's Island, which is his utopian novel of this radical free love idea, where you have this island, this culture that's Buddhist and agnostic to metaphysical things. And they are open sexually. It was written in the 50s, so it's like a countercultural country. Countercultural country. There we go. That's a hard one to say. 10 times fast. And this is just an example. It's basically just a book of conversations between a potential, which I'm not sure if I would feel comfortable in the society described in this book. I feel like I'm even too attuned to my Westernness and my materialism. It would be difficult for me to move into this place. But it's a lot of back and forth conversations between the main character, Will, who is a castaway who crash lands on the island. He's a journalist and he has intentions to try to sell the island to the oil fields. And then the representations of the island who are good-willed and compassionate. So they take him in and they try to show him their lives. And there's a lot of political and religious and philosophical conversations just interdispersed through wonderful scenery. His ability to describe a situation is impeccable. And I would encourage anybody who has any interest in a good fiction novel to try it, especially if you have any spiritual leanings when it comes to any of these ideas that I talk about on the show. It's thick and I enjoyed it. Here he goes. You seem to have solved your economic problems pretty successfully. Solving them wasn't difficult. To begin with, we never allowed ourselves to produce more children than we could feed, clothe, house, and educate into something like full humanity. Not being overpopulated, we have plenty. But though we have plenty, we've managed to resist the temptation that the West has now succumbed to, the temptation to overconsume. We don't give ourselves to coronaries by guzzling 6 times as much saturated fat as we need. We don't hypnotize ourselves into believing that 2 television sets will make us twice as happy as 1 television. And finally, we don't spend 1/4 of the gross national product preparing for World War III or even World War's baby brother, Local War 3004. Armaments, universal debt, and planned obsolescence, those are the 3 pillars of the Western prosperity. If war, waste, and moneylenders were abolished, you'd collapse. And while you people are overconsuming, the rest of the world sinks more and more deeply into chronic disaster. Ignorance, militarism, and breeding. These three, and the greatest of these is breeding. No hope, not the slightest possibility of solving the economics problem until that one's under control. As population rushes up, prosperity goes down. He traced the descending curve with an outstretched finger. And as prosperity goes down, discontent and rebellion, the forefinger moved up again. Political ruthlessness and one-party rule, nationalism and bellicosity begin to rise. Another 10 or 15 years of uninhibited breeding in the whole world, from China to Peru via Africa and the Middle East, will be fairly crawling with great leaders, all dedicated to the suppression of freedom, all armed to the teeth by Russia or America, or better still, by both at once, all waving flags, all screaming for Lebensraum. What about Paula? Will asked. Will you be blessed with a great leader 10 years from now? Not if we can help it, Dr. Robert answered. We've always done everything possible to make it very difficult for a great leader to arise. Gah, I fucking love him. It gives me shivers, man. I really enjoy this guy's style of writing, so I'll probably share more of it in the future. I hope you enjoyed that little excerpt and my attempted performance. I'm going to go get O, and then we'll say bye to you.
Hello, it's Asko and the Gingerbread Man today. So, how is your guys' morning?
No. Your mouth is bright blue.
That's true.
What'd you eat?
I forgot what it's called.
Jello?
Jello! Well, I keep forgetting it, what it's called.
You need to stop picking your nose, too. I can see blood.
Yeah, that's true. I've been scratching my nose. It's itchy.
You don't want to do that. It hurts.
That's true.
Anyways, you got any advice for anybody?
Yeah. Well, my advice is, actually, I don't have a advice. I'm not lying. I actually don't.
How are you going to have the best day possible today?
Well, there's many versions of having the best day possible. And I say there's many versions.
Fair?
Yeah.
And philosophically, you're probably correct.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
I like it.
Well, so, bye.
Bye.
Bye.